From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a bipartisan report from the state legislature responds to the Flint water crisis. We'll break it down for you. Plus, changes in Canada's assisted suicide laws and a crisis of conscience for a Windsor physician.
Well, you could see doctors who live close to the border in Windsor giving up their medical licenses and now practicing in Michigan.
The Parents' Guide to Autism, a tool for parents of children who are on the spectrum.
Kids with autism are the number one void because we give them the best response because of our social issues and because of our issues with sight, sound, and touch.
And Comic Con, just for women.
If you like to read, there's a comic for you. Like, there's all kinds of different stories. I mean, they have Pride and Prejudice in comic book form now.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the Flint water disaster has played out, one central question has always been, how do we keep this from happening again in Michigan? A joint committee of the state legislature was charged with answering that question. After hearing testimony from over 60 witnesses, the bipartisan committee today released a long list of recommendations. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is with us now. Rick, break it down for us. What are the big steps the committee recommends?
Changes to Michigan's emergency manager law, changes in how the Department of Environmental Quality is supervised, even things like testing children's teeth when they fall out to see if they have lead in them. That's considered a very reliable way to check, you know, long after blood tests are no longer useful to find out if children have lead in their system. Just a whole panoply of legislative proposals, most of which probably won't get acted on this year because we're just running out of time.
And even though the fact is this is a bipartisan committee, it's made up of members of the state Senate and House. Does that augur well ultimately for the legislature adapting these?
Let's dive into that a little bit, because this is a report put out under the letterhead of the Joint Legislative Committee, but it was really just released by the office of the committee chair, State Senator Jim Stomas. Now, his Democratic counterpart, State Senator Jim Ananick of Flint, did have some good things to say about the report, but this has never been formally adopted or voted on. We don't know if this is a majority view or a unanimous view or something else, that these are, but these are basically a set of recommendations that Jim Stomas's office picked as being worthy of consideration to ensure that there aren't more Flints in the future.
So what does this mean? I mean, after this huge environmental disaster that drew worldwide attention, that they're putting out something that no one's really behind?
We don't know that, because there was never any, and we don't know if there is going to be a vote to adopt this report. So we know that this is what the chair of the committee thinks ought to be done, but we don't know whether or not that's a majority position, a minority position, whether or not maybe there would even be some kind of a minority report. We know that there's not buy-in to all of the things in this report, but we don't know how much buy-in on this committee there is. You know, this is being billed as a bipartisan report, and in fact, it is a report that is bipartisan in some of its recommendations, but not so much in the other ones.
There's also attention paid to state employees, is there not?
That is certainly one of the most controversial aspects of this, that the committee report, and Democrats will not go along with this, will not, just won't, does endorse House Speaker Kevin Cotter's idea to put a question on the ballot that would relax state civil service rules, that would require an amendment to the state constitution to make it easier to discipline public employees. And Democrats are saying that's a no-go.
Why is that? Because it hasn't accountability of people who mishandled the whole Flint situation been a key issue?
What Democrats and unions are saying is that it actually reduces accountability, because there were instances of public employees trying to step forward and talk about the problems with how things were going in Flint, and they were basically shut down by higher-ups. And so making it easier to discipline those employees would actually make it harder for them to step forward in cases like this rather than otherwise. Another controversial proposal that environmental groups are already taking aim at is changing how the Department of Environmental Quality is governed. People with long memories would remember back in the 1990s, Governor John Engler, a Republican, famously and controversially eliminated a lot of boards that had oversight responsibility over some environmental questions, and he divided the Natural Resources Department, the portion of it that had environmental protection responsibilities, and that director was appointed directly by the governor. Well, this would give that authority to a commission that would oversee the DEQ, and what the environmental groups are saying is that five of the seven people in this commission would come out of the industry side of the equation, the regulated community basically being allowed to choose the chief regulator over what they do. So that's certainly going to be a controversy if and when that gets put forward.
What's in the report for people in Flint?
Well, a lot of attention has been paid to infrastructure and replacing lead service lines. One of the things that they're saying is that partial replacement of those service lines should not be the common way to deal with that, that you have to replace the whole system in most cases, probably with plastic pipe, or not do it at all. Now, one of the questions about that is, how do you pay for it? Now, there is some talk about increasing water fees because right now water fees don't cover the costs of the program. But there's a lot of infrastructure that we're talking about. It will cost millions, maybe billions of dollars. And there's no discussion in this and how all of that infrastructure will be paid for. That there's talk we will see action this week in the legislature on making Flint a promise zone so that it's easier to raise money so that kids in Flint can have an affordable higher education. There is talk about allowing them, this will also be voted on this week, to let them tax themselves about half a mil to create an oversight panel on the recovery efforts and how that money is spent.
So here we have this 33-page report released today. Now what?
Now we wait and see what happens, how many of these things are moved forward, how many of these things are moved forward this year, and how many of these things are dealt with next year when the legislature comes back. That there are 35, 36 recommendations here, and that's a lot to get done with the few session days that we have left in 2016.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. As always, thanks, Rick.
Always a pleasure, Cindy.
And with us now, one of the six members of the Joint Select Committee, Flint Democratic Senator Jim Ananick. Welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How satisfied are you with these three dozen recommendations?
What I've been saying from the beginning is that, you know, I'm going to be about getting results for the families of Flint. And I think the recommendations are a good step, you know, but the real key would be whether or not I get those recommendations into actual laws and actual public acts and make sure that we get it over the finish line. That's what I'll keep working on, but I think it's a good start.
What are the most crucial elements of this plan in your view?
Well, you know the acknowledgement that the emergency manager and the culture created by the governor need to be changed and need to be looked at and need to be transformed, I think, is a good step. Obviously, lead and copper rule changes and oversight of the DEQ and citizen involvement and ombudsman's, you know, so there's oversight, you know, basically making sure that there's voice for the citizens. You know, I've always focused on three things, you know, it's public health for the residents of Flint, but of course the entire state. The emergency manager law reform and repeal, and making sure that the families of Flint get all the things they need for not just the short term, but for the long term. And I think this report is a blueprint to help, you know, some of that. And obviously there'll be more to do after, but it's a good start.
And what do you think it's going to take to get these recommendations passed? I guess I'm wondering how confident you are that the full legislature will take this and move on it.
You know, it's my understanding that the majority had a number of conversations with folks in the House, obviously House leadership, and I'll do the same thing on my side of the aisle. But I believe that there is, I believe this is a document that's meant to get passed and meant to be taken to the next level and, you know, have a number of steps along the way. And I think we'll, I'll push and I'll be pushing hard to make sure that happens.
I know that as hearings went on over the spring, you were unhappy, very clearly unhappy, with the decision to not call Governor Snyder or the former Flint emergency managers before the committee.
Yeah, I mean, no question about it. I mean, if I was the chairman of the committee, it would have been different. There's no question about that. But, you know, they chose to go in the more prospective route, looking forward. How do we make sure this doesn't happen again? And I think there's a number of recommendations to do that. I think, you know, from a standpoint of the holistic approach to the Flint water, there was areas that I think were missing. There's no question about that. And I think, you know, I would have started the committee earlier, and I would have made sure that everyone who was involved would have been before the committee. But, you know, even with that being said, a number of recommendations are real positive recommendations that I think, if passed and when passed, will be very helpful to citizens of Flint, but also to the families all across the state.
Yeah, how do you plan to make this not just another report, something that will get looked at and talked about and then put on a folder, in a folder on a shelf?
Yeah, that's an important question. And I think one of the benefits is that it specifically highlights specific bills. So there's bills that are in place now and has bill numbers and sponsors, and it suggests that those bills need to be passed or maybe amended a little bit, maybe with some of them, but passed. I'm hopeful that we'll have some of them even passed this week, at least the Senate, and then we'll push to get a number of them passed before the end of the year. And, you know, when you put a report out, then that's a document to hold people accountable for, right? I mean, you put something out, you know, if it's just to get press, that's one thing. But I think when you put something out, I'm going to expect that those recommendations get put in place, at least the ones I agree with, which is many of them.
What does this report say first to people who work for the state of Michigan?
I think it shows that there was a culture put in place from the governor's office down that was about secrecy, was about, you know, holding back information from the public, was about, you know, sort of this Lansing knows best approach. And I hope it sends more of a message to the public that there was an acknowledgement that that's the wrong approach. You know, there's some mention there about civil service reform, which I do not support. It was no testimony in any way, shape, or form that suggested there was anything to do with that. That's something that there's going to be disagreement on, and I will not support that. But hopefully it shows to people all across the state, whether you work for the government or you don't, or you're just a person who's a citizen, that openness, transparency, oversight, and citizen involvement is a positive thing, not a negative thing that was treated in Flint for the last few years.
Senator, do you think these recommendations will encourage or discourage whistleblowing?
I'm hopeful that it will increase whistleblowing, and I think we need to do more to make sure that we support that. People need to come forward when they see something wrong. I think that we all learned, hopefully every citizen in the state and probably all across the world know, that there was people that knew about this and chose not to say anything. And obviously the criminal investigations that are going on, we'll find out why, and there'll be people held accountable for that. But I think it's in all of our responsibilities to make sure that everyone speaks up when something's as wrong as this.
And finally, what does this report and these recommendations in your mind say to people in Michigan and particularly people in Flint?
Well, the people of Flint have a long way to go before they have trust again. And I think this is a step in the direction, if we get these bills passed, of showing people that government should work for people and it should protect people and protect the public health. And these recommendations will help do that if we get them passed. And I'm going to fight to make sure that they are passed.
Flint Democratic Senator Jim Ananick, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And we asked to speak with Senator Jim Stamos, the author of the report. His spokesperson was unable to make him available before we went to air. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The for sale sign is out on a building on Cass Avenue in Midtown Detroit. And that sign represents the end of an era. The building houses the Big Bookstore, one of the very last independent bookstores left in Metro Detroit. After 80 years, the store's owner, John King, has decided to shut it down. There's just not enough business to justify keeping doors open. And that means big changes are looming for the store's manager. Bill Foulkes has worked there since the 1970s. He's with us now. Bill, how did Big Bookstore begin in Detroit?
I have heard rumors that it was started by a tinsmith who moved back to New York. At least that's where somebody old came in, 34 years ago when I got the job, and said, I remember when there was a tinsmith here.
Now, when did you discover the Big Bookstore, Bill?
Oh, I started down here in 75, you know, at Wayne State, and probably about 79 or 80, I started actually hanging around the streets and not being a commuter student.
And you saw the store? And
I saw the store and went in, yeah, around 1980, I think.
And what has kept you working there all these years?
The people, perhaps. I've known some of these guys I'm thinking of a couple that I met at another store I managed in the 70s. you know, and I've known most of these people forever. Yeah.
So you see people coming in, you get to know them certainly through the years.
Yeah.
When did you begin noticing that the number of customers stepping through the door was starting to dwindle? I mean, was it a fast transition or a slower one?
A slower one, yeah, like I would think. I don't know, 5-6 years ago, maybe more.
When I think of the fact you're in that area of Detroit that we used to know as the Cass Corridor, it was kind of artsy and lots of students, and now it's Midtown. How has that neighborhood changed and the people in it in that transition from the Cass Corridor to Midtown?
Less artsy, more money, honestly. You know, I mean, it's different, and I don't know how to describe it other than that. When I first got down here in the 70s, there were a bunch of little stores and stuff, and that's come back, but for 30 years, they were mostly abandoned buildings and stuff.
So almost people aren't thinking of, I want to go find a book on Cass.
Right. A lot of the downturn came, of course, from people reading it on Nooks and their phones and stuff like that there.
So suddenly people are going digital, including for textbooks and that. So
yeah.
And kind of tell us, what have you got there at the big bookstore? Because it really hasn't changed, has it?
No, not really. It's a general interest bookstore. We have things like comics. I'm looking at the sections now, occult books, cookbooks, a little bit of a lot. I don't say a little bit of everything because then they come in and ask for Albanian dance books or something. So a little bit of a lot.
Do you have any idea, Bill Folks, how many volumes you have at the big bookstore?
None.
A lot.
A lot.
A lot. And is it kind of all filed in your head? So if I came in and said, gee, I'd really like a book on Irish history, you'd be able to steer me toward it.
Yeah, I can do that. I always get these people who ask for these unusual titles. Somebody asked me for something that was like a title that you would remember just from the weirdness of the title. And then he was like, how do you know that? And I'm like, I'd remember a title like that.
It stuck in your mind. Bill, what kind of customers are coming in these days? Like how many and what are they in for?
Well, these days, since the publicity, I've been getting a little bit of everybody. A lot of the time what I get are students on break, you know, the old guard that have been coming for years. Religion has gone up in sales in recent years.
Hmm.
And, of course, the people that just moved into the area or have been in the area for a long time. I've just discovered I know two people who've been here since 1962.
Makes you feel like a fixture. You know, you mentioned that, you know, people are reading books on their Kindles or their tablets, mm-hmm. their phones. What do you think about that when you see that, when you consider holding a book in your hand and holding a tablet?
I like the tactile feeling there. I don't particularly like holding a tablet or a, you know, a phone would be weird to me because it's so small. Well, it depends. Some phones are large these days, aren't
sure,
they?
Sure, but not as large as a book.
Exactly.
What do you feel? You've been working at the big bookstore since around 1980. You've had years and years there.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Bill, is so special about bookstores like the big bookstore?
I'll tell you, one of the things that happens occasionally is twice last week with the onslaught of people after the publicity, I was just wandering, you know, helping other people. And there was a couple times when people talked for an hour by themselves. I had nothing to do with it. There seems to be a social thing about going to a bookstore, too. I think we're losing that.
Conversations get started. And I guess when you think about buying books, if people are hopping online and just clicking and the book gets sent to their house, you've, again, lost a chance to interact with other people.
Not to get too philosophical, but I was thinking, and technology seems to do that, make us more isolated.
Bill, what do you think you're going to do when the store closes, when ultimately it's sold and John King closes it? What's ahead for you?
I'm trying to figure that out.
It's hard to really say goodbye to the better part of 4 decades.
Yeah, exactly. I'll have to get used to not being here.
Bill Folks is the manager of the soon-to-be-closed Big Bookstore. There is still time for you to come visit this store. Again, one of the final independent bookstores left in Metro Detroit. You'll find it on Cass Avenue, just north of I-94 near Wayne State University. Bill, good luck to you, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
kicking open the door to the Boys Club, bringing opportunities to women who want to make their mark on the comic book and gaming world. That's the mission of Comic-Con. It's a comic book convention specifically for women who create comics. It's happening October 22nd in Dearborn at the Arab American Museum. Here with us are two women from Southeast Michigan who are indeed making their marks in the comic and gaming world. Chelsea Liddy, the founder of Comic-Con, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Good to have you here. And we say hello to Kathleen Hiraga, who's the founder and the CEO of PopPost. It's a multimedia platform, and it's designed to bring women in the comic and gaming industry together. Kathleen, welcome.
Very nice to be here.
Chelsea, tell us what happens at Comic-Con. How is it different from the comic cons that people know?
Well, I think it's a really special atmosphere that just happens naturally when you have a bunch of supportive women working for the same industry in a room. I think that everyone came away from last year's event feeling that this was something special. It's something different from a lot of the bigger cons. It's something that's intimate and fun and a really supportive atmosphere and safe atmosphere for women to talk about their craft, to meet new people, to be introduced to new projects and get really excited about the comics industry from a female perspective.
Now, is it safe to say this sounds like it's we're aiming it at content creators maybe more than fans?
The convention is totally open to anyone who wants to come from all kinds of different backgrounds, but we specifically bring in female comic creators as our featured guests and our exhibitors.
Kathleen, PopPost is your push to build a culture and a community for women who create games and comics and animation. Can you talk a little bit about what happens when all of these groups fit together in one big community?
Yes, it's really about that community becoming a voice and together really expanding into a force that goes beyond what I think is pretty much a gender-based, or in the past has been a highly male-calibrated space. But as we're looking at how many artists online are featured illustrators, game designers, comic, webcomic designers, artists, we see that there's a real voice and presence online, which is converting now into these big Comic-Cons. We're looking at almost a split room, 50-50.
Mm. And how does PopPost specifically, how are you making that happen?
Sure. So my background is in the entertainment industry over the years, MTV, Nickelodeon in New York, and then in the film industry in L.A. And I'm really a publisher. PopPost is a publisher of this work, okay, rather than myself being a content creator, although I've been creating content for a long time. And by featuring not only comics but also gaming and animation, we created a video series, two video series, Sandbox, which is for gaming, and Pop Art, which is around animation. And having these long discussions that are featured on YouTube, rather than just sound bites, but really interviewing these content creators. So we've set the stage with the online platform, and we're also looking to convert this fan community into live events.
And again, as we say, kicking open the door to the Boys Club, and we cannot talk about that without getting into something that was going on in a big way this time 2 years ago, Gamergate. Chelsea, what happened then? Give us some background.
Essentially what happened is there was a lot of, there was an explosion of criticism against female gaming creators, so women that create video games, and then journalists that are working in the gaming industry, particularly women. And there was an explosion of like rape and death threats that happened against people like Anita Sarkeesian, who has a web series called Feminist Frequency, where she critiques video games, like tropes in video games, so sexist tropes in video games. And she was experiencing, I'm sure her web presence still experiences a ton of harassment. And that was, I don't want to say it inspired Comic-Con, but it made me want to do something positive after that happened, because I couldn't believe that this amount of misogyny and harassment was happening in the fall of 2014. Like, in 2014, this is still happening. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right, right. How did it impact you, Kathleen?
You know, it's still impacting me. It really has become the political voice and POV that I feel very strongly about. I feel that there needs to be a middle ground here. One of my strategic partners is a company called Penny Arcade. They've been around for 15 years. And they kind of had their own Gamergate. They're an online platform. They're very, very popular, but very male-centric. They've converted into one of the largest shows in the Comic-Con calendar called Penny Arcade Expo. And, you know, what really inspired me was to create a female Penny Arcade, but with the point of view of featuring panels with game designers, female game designers, professional gamers, to really speak to this space. And not in
and the fact that this kind of, you know, death threats aimed at women or rape threats in 2014 and probably not still going on, but
still
maybe
going on,
still going on,
still going
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
And with this sort of, we call it trolling, with this foundation of anonymity, which is that's what it's all about. You know, we've all wondered if these are 12-year-old boys or people with firearms. But I just got accepted into a South by Southwest panel, which last year was kind of a viral conversation because South by Southwest had actually pulled a gaming panel that four women had created because they had so many death threats. Mm. It's just hard to believe. So this year I was accepted. It's called Gender Bias in Gaming, Do We Have Liftoff Yet? And I've let them know that they cannot pull that panel. So
it has to happen.
It's going to happen.
And do we have liftoff in gender bias, do you think? Is the answer maybe sort of yes, no? What's the answer?
It still is the elephant in the room. We're talking about Blizzard, you know, all of the big games, gamers, game designers, Activision. They are looking at their consumer being a global female, and yet they are afraid to take it on because it becomes a political lightning storm. So I really feel we have an opportunity, not only with our platform being kind of what Penny Arcade is to the male demographic, we are the female demographic. So it's a lightning in a bottle time for us to really address this, I think.
And here we have Kumi-kun coming up on the 22nd. Right now, I am talking with Kathleen Hiraga, who's the founder and CEO of PopPost, a multimedia platform bringing women in the comic and animation and gaming industries together, and Chelsea Liddy, who's the founder of Kumi-kun, coming up in Dearborn on October 22nd, a comic book convention aimed for women who create comics. And Chelsea, I'm going to tell you, I was that kid who loved comic books growing up. Superman in particular,
yeah?
Superboy, The Flash. Which got me wondering, I'm a baby boomer, what kind of comics are women and girls reading and creating today?
Oh my gosh, there's so many different kinds. I think there's a lot of angles to that answer. I think that now more than ever, the big two, so Marvel and DC, are diversifying both their creators and their characters. I mean, it's slow, but it's happening. One of my favorite creations in recent years is Ms. Marvel, the Kamala Khan Ms. Marvel, which she's the first Pakistani-American superhero, and she was created by an editor at Marvel in addition to the writer, who's G. Willow Wilson. And G. Willow Wilson's a Muslim woman creator, and I think that sort of speaks to how diverse the industry is getting. But even more than that, I think that with the advent of and the popularity of webcomics and self-publishing, women are getting the platforms and the resources through mechanisms like crowdfunding to be able to tell the stories that women can relate to and that, you know, get even more and more people into comics. Because I always like to say that if you like to read, there's a comic for you. Like, there's all kinds of different stories. I mean, they have Pride and Prejudice in comic book form now.
Well, see, that's what Classics Illustrated was. It was all the great classics done in comic book form. And so as a 5- and 6-year-old kid, I remember, you know, reading Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island in comic form. They were terrific. And I thought we also should talk about comic strips. And I'm thinking, for example, of how long University of Michigan alum Kathy Geiswhite's strip Kathy ran. That was 34 years. Did she kick open the door for other women in comic strips?
You know, I think she might have. There were so few women creators back in that day. But one of the things we've seen, and Chelsea kind of touched on it, was we have this equalizer with the internet. And so you don't have to worry about how you're going to get your content out there. The main challenge is how you distribute it and discovery. So that's a challenge in social media. But I think that it's, again, it's something that an independent artist can take on without all of those barriers of entry. And we're featuring an artist. Her name is Sarah Anderson. She pens Sarah Scribbles. And we're so lucky to have her. She's one of the most viral voices, but it's also a very personal voice. So we have her on the Pop Post rotation. She has 25,000 comments if she puts a comic up on Facebook. It's completely viral. And I think that people become very sort of emotionally attached to
invested.
That person,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And so it's not only just about, oh, look at this particular comic. It's really about who is this person, what's their story, and it's, this is a point of view that is their point of view.
Well, it's very, very clear from hearing both of you talk that the ongoing Pop Post platform really beautifully complements this big event that's happening with Comic Con, celebrating women in comics. And it'll be Saturday, October 22nd at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. You can find out all the details by going to comiccon.com, and that's comiqueconcom, and go to poppost.com to learn more about Pop Post, but don't forget to put the hyphen between pop and post. So pop-post.com. Chelsea Liddy, Kathleen Hiraga, you are fun to talk with, and thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Cindy. You're awesome.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This past August in Lansing, the Death with Dignity Act was introduced in the legislature by State Representatives Sam Singh and Tom Cochran. Its stated purpose, to create a legally regulated method for terminally ill patients to have the option to get a prescription drug, allowing them to die when they choose. The issue has certainly been spotlighted in our state for decades, largely because of the late Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Currently, it's a dilemma that Ontario physicians are facing. In 2015, Canada's Supreme Court struck down the federal law prohibiting medically assisted suicide. Because of that, Parliament passed legislation clearing the way for doctor-assisted deaths. In Ontario, the service is now covered by the Ontario Health Insurance Plan. Any drugs required to help a patient die would be available at no cost. Dr. Brad Burke is a physician in Windsor who said assisted dying goes against his conscience, and he's making plans for the day when a patient asks him for help in dying. Dr. Burke, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Tell us a little about, first of all, the type of medicine you practice and where it is in Windsor that you practice.
Sure. I'm a physical medicine rehabilitation specialist, so our specialty helps to decrease pain, improve function, to improve quality of life overall. I work at the Windsor Regional Hospital doing inpatient consults, and also I do quite a bit of medical legal work.
Well, here we go. So medical legal work, this is perfect. So the Supreme Court decision happened early in 2015, and the laws changed this past June, allowing physician-assisted suicide. So I've got that right?
Yes.
What kinds of discussions and debates, Dr. Burke, did you have with other doctors in those intervening 16 months?
Well, it goes back and forth. There's a number of doctors, of course, who are opposed to physician-assisted suicide and want nothing to do with it. There's been a lot of debate, actually, amongst the provinces as to how they're going to roll this out. Ontario, for example, is forcing doctors against their conscience to refer patients for not only abortion, but also for physician-assisted suicide.
So every province is kind of taking its own approach.
That's right. It looks like there will probably be other provinces following Ontario right now. That makes Ontario really the only jurisdiction in the world that allows physician-assisted suicide that also forces doctors against their consciences to either perform the procedure or refer to someone else who will.
When you say against forcing doctors, so it says, the system says you could, if you can't do it, you can refer that patient to another physician who is willing to assist. Why does that still pose a problem for you?
That's like being an accomplice to a murder. Think of it in this way. Imagine you or someone came up to me and said, "You know, I want to die, but I want to make it look like a murder. I don't want to make it look like a suicide. So I want someone to kill me." And, you know, it might be to defraud insurance company, life insurance company, or something of that sort. And imagine if I said, "Well, you know, I can't really pull the trigger of the gun, but here, let me find someone who will." And so I arrange to have someone kill that person. In a court of law, I would be criminally charged with committing a crime.
Now, has anyone requested your help yet?
Not yet. not yet. The College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario is kind of playing it a little low right now. So even if someone was to complain to them, they'd probably drag their heels for a bit. And the reason for that is because it's in the courts right now. There's a lawsuit against Ontario for this policy that they have. So they're trying to keep it quiet right now because anything like that would actually have people feel sorry for the doctors because they're being forced against their conscience to do something they don't want to do.
Take us into the room with you, Dr. Burke. Let's say a patient comes to you seeking help in dying. What kind of alternatives would you offer? How would you counsel that patient?
First of all, I'd listen to them and listen very closely to the reason why they want to die. Most of the time, patients just don't understand what good palliative care is or what doctors do. That seems to be one of the reasons why so many people in Canada agree with it, is because they don't understand that doctors who perform palliative care can help relieve pain in a number of different ways. They think palliative care is just making the person live for as long as possible while they're suffering. Palliative care involves providing pain medications to help with their pain. I would help the person understand that they can request different procedures, different pain medications. And what doctors do is, I'm also a pain specialist, so we keep escalating the pain medications for someone who's terminally ill. And there's no fear of addiction, right, because these individuals are going to die. So we keep going up on the pain medications to help make them comfortable. And so when they are in the terminal stages of their disease, we can do many things to help relieve their suffering. And that's actually what most people want. They just want to be comfortable when they die, and that's what good palliative care can do.
How far are you prepared to go in resisting this law, Dr. Burke? I mean, are you prepared to lose your license to practice medicine in Ontario?
I am. I've also I've made plans in case that does happen. So I renewed my Michigan medical license. Even though I do practice in Canada, I actually live in Michigan, and I only practice in Canada. So right now, things are set up the way where I'm living. I'm even board certified in the U.S., so I could start practicing in Michigan next week and give up my Ontario medical license altogether.
So you've got a plan B. Do you know other doctors who are building a plan B as well?
They're not as in good a situation as I am right now because they're living in Ontario. They'd have to move to another province or country to work. So some in Ontario might end up moving to Alberta, or they could move to the U.S. God's put me in a good position right now where I can start working immediately in a different country if I need to.
I'm wondering what impact you think we in Michigan could see from this new legalization in Ontario between either physicians maybe moving to Michigan or maybe Michiganders going to Ontario to seek physician-assisted suicide.
Well, you could see doctors who live close to the border in Windsor giving up their medical licenses and now practicing in Michigan. You could see that. I don't think that those in Michigan could go across the border and receive the services. I don't think that's allowed just yet. I think you'd have to be a resident of Ontario.
So if a physician like you or a faith-based hospital system will not offer a patient medical assistance to die, those patients would have to find an alternative medical system, even when they're at, you know, in the most terrible health in their lives. How are they supposed to pick up and move to another hospital?
That can be difficult. Sometimes the patients or a patient advocate or the family members would be able to seek out other doctors, other facilities who would perform the procedure and allow a transfer like that. I don't think there's any doctors who would try to prevent a transfer like that. They just don't want to be responsible for an actual referral for such. Mm-hmm. So in some cases, it might be it might be difficult for the patient, especially if they did not have any family members who could advocate for them in that manner. What the CPSO should do, what the Government of Canada should do, is strike a balance between the rights, supposed rights of those who want to die with the freedom of conscience of doctors who don't want to refer against their conscience.
And how far along is the legal challenge? What's your feeling as far as how that might come down in Ontario?
I heard that things were scheduled tentatively for the winter of 2017, but I heard they're trying to get it moved up to this fall to have a judge hear the case. Right now, there are no individuals that have lost their medical licenses, in Ontario. But as soon as that court challenge goes through, it's a possibility that it could start right away.
A moral dilemma for physicians in Ontario. Dr. Brad Burke, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
One of the most likely group of children to be on the receiving end of bullying is the child on the autism spectrum. Just think for a moment of the emotional impact of that photo of Travis Rudolph, the Florida State football star, sitting and having lunch during a school visit with a sixth grader named Bo, a child who has autism, after Travis noticed Bo sitting all by himself. My next guest understands what that's like. Ron Sanderson of Rochester Hills has Asperger's syndrome. Ron has written a book for parents of children on the spectrum. It's called A Parent's Guide to Autism, Practical Advice, Biblical Wisdom. Ron Sanderson, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thanks so much, and thanks for having me on your show.
Before we get into your book, Ron, tell us your story. I know you were a toddler in the late 1970s, and certainly our knowledge of autism has come a long, long way since then. When did your parents begin to notice that there was something different about you?
My development began normal, and then at 18 months, I lost my ability to learn words I had previously learned. At 9 months, I could say mommy, and I went at 18 months to only say mom. And I lost the ability to have all eye contact and to respond to my mom's voice. And right then, she knew that something was wrong. Having two sons who weren't on the autism spectrum and without disabilities, she knew that I was totally different than those two sons.
And what I understand, doctors didn't think you would read beyond maybe the seventh grade? You wouldn't really have a future?
Yeah, the doctors told my parents I'd never read beyond the seventh grade level, I'd never attend college, I'd never excel in sports, and I wouldn't have meaningful relationships. I graduated college, undergrad, with two bachelor's degrees in psychology and theology with a 3.9 grade point average. I got my master's of divinity with a perfect 4.0 grade point average. I'm married now going on 4 years, December 7th. I got married on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and I like to joke that having autism, I came in like a kamikaze in the family. And I also have a brand-new baby daughter who was born March 20th at 3:13 a.m., Michaela Marie. And I received full ride to college my first year for track and cross country. So my mom, using her techniques, was able to prove the experts wrong. She went from being an art teacher to being a Ron teacher, and that became her full-time job.
And here you are now. You've written this book, A Parent's Guide to Autism, Practical Advice, Biblical Wisdom, after confounding every prediction that your doctors made when you were a kid. What inspired you to write this book, Ron?
What inspired me to write the book is to share what parents can versus can't. My mom was always told what I can't do instead of what I can do. Temple Grandin, in the foremost expert in autism, says focus on what the child can do rather than what they can't do. And that's what my mom did.
Now, you've interviewed parents of kids with autism and experts in the field for your book. What are some of the common themes, Ron, that you heard from them?
One of the common themes I've heard from parents with autism is the lack of understanding of autism and the lack of opportunities. One of the main ones I think of is Clay Marzo, who's a professional surfer. He got a six-digit contract with a major surfing company, and when he met the CEO, he did not look him in the eye, did not shake his hands, and the first person to lose their contract was Clay because they thought he was uninterested. There's a young adult from New York, Mikey Branning, who I interviewed, him and his mom, and he's the fastest runner mile in the United States for his age at 19. He can run the mile in 3 minutes and 57 seconds. And the NCAA won't let him run Division I because he doesn't have high enough grades. And what people need to realize with autism is that with autism, you put all your eggs in one basket. So if your gift is running, in the running is your communication. In the running is your ability to develop social skills. And that for a Division I NCAA to tell him that he cannot compete takes away the very opportunities to develop those gifts. And my message is inclusion. If there's a disability, learn about the disability and accommodate for the disability, but allow people to use the amazing gifts that they've been given and don't hold them back because of rules or regulations that you maybe had in the past.
You know, talking about bullying, Ron Sanderson, you went through it. You endured it, especially in elementary and grade school. You have that insider's perspective. So what can you tell teachers and school administrators, what can they do to end bullying in classrooms and corridors and lunchrooms and online?
One of the things I think that's key to ending bullying is for people to have an awareness of what disabilities are. Every person, if they live long enough, will have a disability. I like to say if you get into your 90s, you're probably going to need glasses, so you have a disability in seeing. If you get even older, you may lose your ability to hear. So let people know that disabilities are part of life. And also let them know that how hard it is for kids with autism when they experience bullying. What I say is most people are like bottled water. They get shaken up, not much is happening. I'm more like Mountain Dew. I'm carbonated, different, and I'm caffeinated. When I get shaken up, watch out, you're going to do the do. And what bullies' number one thing they look for is response. That's why kids with autism are the number one bullied, because we give them the best response because of our social issues and because of our issues with sight, sound, and touch.
Ron, what do you say to parents of children with autism as far as things they can do to help their kids get past the bullies and others who marginalize them, I guess by boosting self-esteem for one thing, right?
Yeah, self-esteem is key, and I think the other one is if you're going into an area where you know there's a high chance that you could be mugged, what would you do? You'd probably wear a bulletproof vest. I also tell people to bully-proof their kid, and one of the number one ways you can help your child not be bullied, who's being bullied, is find a mentor for them from the school, a kid who's one grade ahead of them, who is with them in the lunchroom, as you mentioned earlier, with the kid who had the football player sitting next to him. No one's going to mess with a football player. So if you have a kid who's a little bit bigger who sits next to your kid with autism or disabilities, it will help protect them from being bullied. And that's one of the things my parents used to keep me from getting bullied when I got in the eighth grade after being bullied in sixth grade, is that the church had young adults in their youth group who'd went to school with me, and the older kids would sit by me, and it made me less of a target for bullying with having friends who are older than me.
And I'm sure you're challenging all teachers and, you know, lunchroom aides and playground aides and bus drivers and school administrators to step in and do something if they see this happen.
Yeah, they need to step in for sure and make sure that kids aren't being picked on. And even if it looks like the kid with autism is picking on them, usually they're just responding. And a lot of times, kids with autism respond slower, so by the time they're responding, it may look like they initiated it, even though they didn't, which teachers and aides need to be aware of.
Ron, your website puts it out there that this is the first Christian book written by an author with Asperger's syndrome. How has your faith played a role, not only in writing your book, but in all of your accomplishments and, you know, taking Asperger's syndrome and succeeding?
I think the number way my faith has helped me succeed is it's made me look to a better tomorrow and also have faith that there's better things out there. I like to share, too, that I'd never be where I am today if it wasn't for my faith in God.
What do you hope parents of children with autism will take away from your book, Ron?
I hope they'll take away that with love and nurture and therapy, anything is possible. Never put limits on a child. No matter how slow they may seem at the time, you give them time, they'll come around. There's an old saying, by perseverance, the snail made it on the ark. And I like to joke, because your kid could be as slow as a snail, but if you keep persevering, in the end, he'll make it to his goal.
Ron Sanderson's book is A Parent's Guide to Autism, Practical Advice, Biblical Wisdom. You can learn more by going to SpectrumInclusion.com. That's SpectrumInclusion.com. Ron, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on Stateside.
Today's program was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.